This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. For as long as there has been life on Earth, there have been new species arising and others disappearing. A handful of times, the rate of disappearances has temporarily skyrocketed during what scientists call mass extinction events. We're currently in the midst of the planet's sixth such event, this one of our own making. Later this hour, author and ocean champion Carl Safina talks about his book Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. And he shares his belief that empathy for endangered animals is one of the most powerful tools we have for stopping extinctions. First, though, let's listen back to part of a conversation I had in 2015 with Kieran Suckling. He's co-founder and executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting endangered species. Scientific research and legal action have been the center's mainstays, but as you'll hear, art is now part of their extinction-fighting portfolio as well. We started by talking about just how fast species are disappearing right now. Here's Kieran Suckling.
We have a pretty good idea that the rate of extinction today is about 1,000 times greater than the natural rate. And how that translates into exact numbers is a little bit mysterious because we don't know exactly how many species there are on the planet. So probably somewhere between about 5 and 13 million species on the planet. But we do know that we're driving the species extinct about 1,000 times faster than ever happened naturally.
I mean, 5 to 13 million is a pretty big range. And as you said, it's not like there are people out there watching as the last member of any given species mm-hmm. disappears. We don't have that kind of hard data for the extinction. So how confident can we be in this estimate of how much faster we're driving species extinct now than they would have otherwise?
Well, pretty confident, surprisingly. Scientists have come up with some very intriguing ways of figuring this out. And so what they do is they go back and they look at the fossil records, and they're able to see species disappear from the fossil record, i.e. go extinct, and from that get a sense of how often species would have gone extinct prior to humans being involved. And that rate was about one species per million per year. And then to understand the current rate, what scientists have done is they've gone back and looked at when we first discovered any given species, and then look at how many years all these species exist over time until they disappear. We see them actually go extinct from the known record. And by comparing those, what they've seen now is that instead of losing about one species per million per year, we're losing about 1,000 per million per year. So it's an extraordinary rate. But I also would say it's not a consistent rate. That's the big global average.
Not consistent in over time or across the globe?
At any level. It's not consistent across the globe. It's not consistent between, say, amphibians and mammals. It's not consistent over time. For example, it seems to be speeding up. And so there's a tremendous variety. So when we say, you know, it's 1,000 times faster, that's the big global average. But within that, if you dive down, for example, the rate of extinction among amphibians is probably on the order of 30,000 times. On the other hand, you can look at the oceans, and we just don't have a clue of what is in the ocean or how fast things are going extinct. We don't have a lot of data from the ocean, so we're not sure there. Another group of species that's really in trouble are the mollusks. Snails, clams, mussels
really?
Are going extinct.
Well, we hear a lot about the frogs, but not a lot about the snails.
No.
Do you think that's just a factor of charisma?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In terms of, like, say, continental United States, by far the greatest extinction spasm we've had is of freshwater mussels in the South.
And what's driving that?
Water development, water pollution, dams,
Is there any overarching theme in the types of human activities that tend to drive extinction? Are there any generalizations we can make about the primary threats?
Yeah, there are. The two main drivers of extinction are habitat destruction is number one, as we cut down the forests, fill the wetlands and so forth, the species disappearing. And then number two is our bringing in exotic species from other places into these ecosystems. And they eat or displace the other species that live there. So those are the two big driving factors. Interesting that, you know, there's a lot of sort of public attention and concern about hunting and direct killing of species, but that actually very rarely drives a species extinct. It's something that's easily managed. It's really not that big of a problem. It's more the habitat loss and the invasives. And now increasingly, global warming. We're starting to see big impacts there. And in the future, it's almost certainly going to be the dominant driver, and scientists are sort of madly scrambling right now to understand how global warming impacts species, because it's surprisingly complicated. It's like this tsunami bearing down on us, but we really don't know all the ways it will affect us. It's a very frightening prospect right now.
Are there geographic hotspots for extinction? Are there certain places in the globe where we're seeing much higher or much more widespread rates of extinction?
Yeah, absolutely. Islands are the biggest place of extinction all over the world, including here in the United States. And so in the U.S., Hawaii by far has the greatest number of extinctions.
Is that because they don't have any place for, I guess, replacements essentially to come in and fill the void?
There's a few different things going on. It's complicated. So one is these species typically have nowhere to go on these small islands. And so as they get sort of pushed, they eventually hit the edge and go off. So that's one. Two, many island species evolve to have very particular conditions that are unique to islands. And often that's the fact that there's no predators on these islands. So a good example here would be there is a very interesting beetle on Nantucket called the American burying beetle, an endangered species there. And the burying beetle, beautiful red and black creature, just amazingly beautiful. It competes oddly with coyotes. It's its main competitor.
How so?
Because the coyotes like to eat these sort of small mammals, medium-sized birds like pigeons. And that's exactly what a burying beetle seeks out to lay its eggs in. And so if you've got coyotes running around essentially eating the birds, there's none left for the burying beetle. And so it ended up, what happened was, it's a fascinating ecological story, as we killed off the bears, lions, wolves, which kept coyote numbers down, then coyote numbers exploded, and then coyotes started eating these small birds and mammals, and then the beetle numbers went down because they weren't there. And so what ended up happening was the last place in the world where the beetles lived were on a block island off of Rhode Island because there were no coyotes there. And so now it's been reintroduced to Nantucket and a few other islands around here where it can survive without predators. And so lack of predators on island and our introduction of predators to them has been a huge cause of extinction. So islands are a really big deal. And then freshwater species have taken it really, really hard because we've diverted all over the world most of the freshwater away. And then finally, large predators have been disappearing all over the world at a tremendous rate because they're in direct competition with humans. And then amphibians and reptiles have also been going down at a much faster rate than others because they're less mobile than other species like birds.
What about microbes? Do they even get included in this, or is it just too much to think about?
No, that's fascinating. We know so little about the microbial world that they're not even counted in these surveys, and they're incredibly important, microbes, bacteria, etc. So we don't have a clue.
Given the rate of extinction that you're talking about, most of us are probably going through our daily lives feeling, at least, completely unaffected by the number of species that are going extinct, whether it's microbes or a beetle on Nantucket. Why is extinction important? Or maybe to put it a different way, why is biological diversity important?
Well, it's important in so many ways. I think first and foremost, it's important just ethically. These are all God's creatures. These things were here for millions, hundreds of millions of years before we ever arrived. And we have an ethical responsibility not to wipe them out. I think most people feel that responsibility. Secondly, they are completely woven into our lives and cultural experience, whether we know that or not, or how much. Now, a good example of that is, we have children, right? And when they're very young, their job is essentially to learn how to become human, right? Our job as parents is to teach them that. So what's the first thing we do is we just surround them with animals, right? The stuffed toys, the books, the whole thing. And you look at it and you think, wow, we are recognizing here that to become a human being, to mature, to understand what it is to live on this planet, we have to immediately surround and teach these kids about all the other species. So there's something very integral to being a human being that has to do with living with lots of species. But then there are a lot of other more practical manners. These species all interact together to keep the ecosystems that we depend on alive and functioning. And so, for example, we've got a huge decline of mussels, both in fresh water and in our marine ecosystems. And they filter pollution out of the water. You know, all the water in Chesapeake Bay over a period of about 3.5 years will be filtered through mussels in Chesapeake Bay. They have an enormous impact. Other species like bees pollinate almost all of our crops.
Yeah,
and
right.
As the bees decline, our crops get in trouble. Animals, by the way, they interact with each other, control where diseases and ticks can appear. For example, Lyme's disease. And what they found is that Lyme's disease was always existed out here in the East. It was always in ticks. But when you've got a higher diversity of different kinds of mammals in the forest, ticks will be more drawn to them. As those numbers decline, the diversity is gone, ticks are more likely to adhere to humans. And so there's this shift that happens to us. And so we may be very concerned about Lyme disease, but not quite realize, oh, this is becoming a problem for us because the other species are disappearing from the landscape.
In addition to science and legal and political action, the Center for Biological Diversity lists creative media as one of the tools for fighting extinction. How do you see art being a part of protecting endangered species?
Well, art is really essential. I think it's very unfortunate that when we think of conservation, protection of species, we tend to immediately think about law and science. They've become the voice of conservation. And they get at critical issues, don't get me wrong. But at the end of the day, conservation is about love. And it's about emotional connection. And art is the language of love. Art is what brings us closer to the world and helps us understand our connectivity with it. And so the center has a lot of art projects going on now because at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is save the species and get people to understand their connectivity with them and the importance of species in our lives, in our culture. And science is just one part of that, and we have to not just go to science every time, but use the other parts of our brains as well.
Kieran Suckling, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Kieran Suckling is co-founder and executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity. You heard him talk about the role of love in conservation. Well, Carl Safina thinks that not only love, but empathy is critical. Up next, the author and ocean champion talks about his transition from scientist to writer and activist, and his latest book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. That's coming up when Living Lab continues after a short break.